Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we learn about methane digesters and how they're helping the dairy industry reduce its greenhouse gas footprint, and what a new show on Valley PBS can teach us about society's relationship with agriculture. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. Also, we visit one company that's keeping the tradition of neon alive in the Valley, one fluorescent tube at a time, and we have a conversation with some of the Valley's youngest politicians.
But first, a recap of the week's news. Presidential candidate and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders canceled visits to college campuses in Fresno and Bakersfield this week. According to his campaign, the senator was briefly hospitalized for a heart procedure following chest pain. His campaign has not said whether Sanders will reschedule the visits.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons announced this week that it'll close a federal prison in Taft at the end of January. Here's Dan Jocelyn with Management and Training Corporation, the company that operates the Kern County facility.
We were completely caught off guard by the news, which, as you can imagine, our employees have found to be very devastating.
According to the federal government, the decision comes after an engineering assessment determined the facility would require $100 million worth of repairs. The decision will leave 2,500 inmates in need of transfers and more than 300 employees in need of jobs.
Also in Kern County, the state oil and gas regulator has issued a $2.7 million fine to oil and gas giant Chevron for an oil seep in the Cimarex oil field west of Bakersfield. The seep, which has flowed intermittently since May, released more than 1.3 million barrels of oily water into a dry stream bed. One factor in the fine, the state said in a statement, was to ensure that Chevron could not profit off the oil it recovered from the seep.
In Fresno, Attorney General Javier Becerra appeared alongside County Sheriff Margaret Mims earlier this week to decry underage tobacco use.
Here in California, one in eight high school students are using tobacco, and of those, about 84% are vaping.
Last year, Becerra provided a $300,000 grant to the sheriff's office to fight tobacco use and vaping by minors. It's part of a $30 million effort statewide, paid for by tobacco taxes.
In southwest Fresno, the city, alongside community partners, opened its largest community garden, a 7.5-acre project. Amber Donnett with the nonprofit Fresno Metro Ministry says the Yosemite Village Permaculture Farm and Community Garden will serve the city's most vulnerable populations.
So we are envisioning this to be a place for people to get access to healthy food in their own backyard, to sell it at reduced rates for community members, and to also help sequester carbon, bring native plant life back into the valley, and transform this land.
Fresno Metro Ministry is organizing a volunteer day tomorrow from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. to plant 400 trees as part of the farm's kickoff.
Listen for more local news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. This year, the Tower Theater in Fresno turns 80 years old, the same age as this song by big band composer Glenn Miller. The theater's iconic marquee and tower has flashed fluorescent pink and purple since it opened in 1939.
The Memorial Auditorium was built then, and so the Tower Theater came just, it was really the very last of those big, glorious neon-lit theaters.
That's Elizabeth Laval, president of the Fresno Historical Society. She says one of the theater's developers worked for the utility company San Joaquin Light and Power.
So of course they wanted to show off their electric power, and that's why that 80-foot star tower was erected there.
And what makes that star tower so flashy is the neon. Today, the theater is on the National Register of Historic Places for its unique architecture. That means as long as the theater remains, the neon has to stay.
I think that the biggest risk to any of our historic sites, one could be a lack of people caring, but the maintenance costs of some of these old buildings, it's very prohibitive for a lot of people.
Maintaining the neon marquee is becoming more and more difficult as fewer and fewer companies offer such specialized work. The fluorescent gas used to light all types of signs, from backlighting to brightly lit accents. But if you pay attention, you'll see fewer and fewer signs sporting the fluorescent lights.
The neon bending and all that also is being a lost trade.
But one company still offers it, the Fresno Neon Sign Company. That's Santiago Bustamante, and he's replacing hundreds of neon tubes that light up the tower.
But right now we're working on that tower ball, the tower itself.
The marquee, too, is lit by hundreds of neon glass tubes, bent to spell the word tower in cursive and hug the rounded edge of the overhang. But despite the longevity of neon, the tubes can still be broken by birds or the weather.
Well, pretty much rewired the whole thing. So by the time we're done, our goal is to have it 100% lit.
The tubes themselves are molded and bent at the company's warehouse in southeast Fresno. You'll know it by its own neon sign. Lining one wall of the warehouse are boxes of phosphor-coated glass, a humming vacuum, and burners producing blue flames. That's where Daniel Hood bends glass tubes to replace broken ones. The company is one of the few that can repair neon locally. Hood believes he's the only neon tube bender in the San Joaquin Valley. He's brightened signs up and down Highway 99.
I got my thumbprint all around the whole valley.
He's a third-generation neon tube bender, and his father taught him how to take the 4-foot glass tubes that neon signs are comprised of and shape them with fire. He lays a white bent tube next to another that's plugged in, glowing bright pink.
This unit right here is for the Tower Theater because it's, as you can see, it's just not flat.
When Hood bends glass, he starts by heating a 4-foot length of tube. He moves it back and forth between the flames. Before even a minute has passed, the glass is on fire, which is what he wants. He brings it out of the flame and bends it into a loop. He does this all with his bare hands.
It takes years of practice, so it's very light. I mean, any little, you know, slip or sometimes it can ruin a bend. That's one of the biggest problems in our industry, the lack of tube benders. There's just nobody to service it, and that's why a lot of people went away from it too.
Most signs now use LED modules. Even the Fresno Neon Sign Company deals outside of neon. Part of their business includes building digital marquees and cutting letters for signs that will be backlit with LEDs. Casey Rudiaga, president of the Fresno Neon Sign Company, would like to keep the work that is the company's namesake going.
Yeah, I mean, I think they represent history, you know, the history of the valley. There's so many signs that Fresno Neon built and maintained over the years, going back to the 30s.
Her father, Bill Kratt, ran the company before her. She remembers going out with him to see the signs he worked on.
He would be so proud of the things that he built that we would, on the weekends, instead of going out to dinner or doing something like that, as a family, we would go out and drive around and he would show us what he built and we all got to see it lit up.
But some of those signs, too, she says, have been updated. Still, she's hoping the company doesn't lose their neon niche.
I think neon signs just pop. You see them from really far away and they catch your eye. The more color, the better. And I just think that compared to the signs of today, they're just more exciting.
Like the Tower Theaters. That one, Rudiaga hopes, will always stay neon. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. You've likely heard a lot lately about prescribed or controlled burns. This idea is not new. In fact, native Californians used fire to maintain the land and also their culture for thousands of years. The following feature is an excerpt from the new podcast, California Burning, out of North State Public Radio, reported by its creator and host, Matt Fidler.
Native Americans all over California managed forests with fire. This kept the forests healthy because fire kills sick and dying vegetation, gives space for plants that need sunlight, and maintains prairies and meadows for game animals to graze. But many people still seem to think that before European settlers came to California, the land was untouched, an idea widely spread by the father of our national parks, John Muir.
What he didn't realize is that the natural places that they saw were not that way by accident or what you might call just naturally, that humans are a part of the ecosystem. And Native people took care of the land, and the land looked like that because of the interaction between humans and nature. There was no separation.
Margot Robbins is the president of the Cultural Fire Management Council of the Yurok Tribe in Northern California. Her ancestors used fire to maintain the surrounding forest before the practice was outlawed. Now, for the first time in generations, the Yurok are bringing back the practice of what they call cultural burns to manage the forest and to support their way of life.
When we put fire on the land, there's something about it that just, it speaks to your spirit. It's like you connect with it.
I spent a weekend with Margot on the Klamath River on the Yurok Reservation, learning about the way that they're using fire. One of them is to propagate plants that are important to the tribe and that need fire to thrive. Plants like pepperwood, which Margot says is used to help alleviate arthritis, and hazel, which is used for basket making.
Fire actually changes the DNA of the plant, and so it's stronger and more flexible, and it also gets rid of the bugs that eat into the plant.
Together, in a spot the Yurok had burned 18 months earlier, Margot and I gathered basket-making materials, which she says will be used to create for her grandchild the first traditional Yurok baby cradle in her family in multiple generations. More than 400 miles south, the Amamutsin tribe near Santa Cruz is also starting to utilize cultural burns again. Valentin Lopez, the tribe's chairman, says for his people, fire serves many purposes.
It's killing the ticks and the fleas and other pests like that in the ground. You know, whenever we pray, we have fire and smoke. While this right here is a way of cleansing and blessing the trees, because then whenever that smoke goes up into the trees, it's smudging the trees, it's blessing the trees.
For the Amamutsin, fire is a tool they use to care for Mother Earth, which Valentin says they have a responsibility to do.
You know, if we're going to restore these lands, and we believe the restoration of Mother Earth must be led by indigenous people, because only indigenous people have the moral authority. Creator gave us that obligation. You know, our evidence must last seven generations.
Valentin Lopez and Margot Robbins shared much, much more with me about how California was carefully cultivated by Native Americans through the use of fire. Listen to the full story at californiaburning.net or wherever you get your podcasts. In Chico, California, I'm Matt Fidler.
That story was from the new podcast, California Burning, out of North State Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. If you look closely at local governments in the San Joaquin Valley, you'll find a handful of city council members in their early 20s. One even ran, and one as a 19-year-old. In the studio this week, moderator Kathleen Schock spoke with three of these local city council members, Joel Hurtado of Kingsburg, Brian Osorio of Delano, and Esmeralda Hurtado of Sanger, about why they chose to run at such a young age and the challenges they face now that they're in office.
I want to get into your experience campaigning, your experience actually in office in a minute. But before we get there, I think the burning question people have is, why would someone so young, so early in their career, be interested in public service? You know, you're all at ages where people are typically focused on school and starting jobs and hanging out with friends. So I'd like each of you to just give us a quick overview of how you got to where you are today. And Jewel, let's go ahead and start with you.
When I was 17, I really just started getting involved by starting registering to vote, you know, registering people to vote. And after that, it just kind of went pretty quickly. It became almost addicting. I loved just serving others and understanding how I could fit in, right? Fit into that, you know, category. So I served on a community services commission, which is a commission that the city council has. And I just really started digging in. I was pregnant at the time. After I had my baby, I started doing more community organizing with different groups and people and friends and interning. And it was just so much fun. but also something I knew I wanted to commit my life to. But then also I had my baby, so it changes things. You know, it changes your look, your outlook on the future, and what you want your community to look like for your children and for my family. So I ran for council because I didn't want to let anybody else make those decisions for me or for my son. And so now here I am.
Great. Brian, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. You know, you just graduated from UC Berkeley. What brought you back to Delano?
I've always wanted to come back to Delano. When I left in 2014 to college, I was always thinking about, you know, what can I do in Delano with what I will be studying? I studied political science and cognitive science. And following the 2016 election, I saw like even a greater urgency to use whatever knowledge and skill sets I had developed in college to give back to my community in a productive and helpful way. And so I really got ingrained into this public service oriented life by being part of student government in Berkeley, but also providing Know Your Rights workshops as a college student. And so when I saw that there was an opportunity to get involved in Delano, I thought that it would be a great way to advocate for often people who are left out of conversations. And so I really took the opportunity and just went along with it.
That's great. Esmeralda, your path is a little different as well. Tell us how you got to where you are.
So I would say my passion for politics all began when I was about, I would say, 11 years old. You know, I have an older sister that's also in politics, and ever since I was like a teenager, she would take me out to register voters at a very young age, going canvassing, knocking door to door. And I think that from there, watching her do that and me being involved in that process, really that's where kind of the light bulb went on, like where I noticed that, you know, there is work that needs to be done in our communities and that there's people who have voices, but are not necessarily heard all the time. So I think that that's what ignited my passion to run for city council in the city of Sanger.
Great. And just to be clear, you went through a different process in terms of taking your seat than the other two guests today.
Correct. So I was appointed in January of 2019. So it was a process where we were appointed by the current council. And the process was basically, the application was open for people to from District 1. So there was a vacant seat, and that used to be, you know, my sister Melissa Hurtado. She was there in District 1, and that seat became vacant. So it became open to anybody who lived in that district to apply and run for that seat. So it was an interview process. So there's about 5 to 6 applicants, including myself. And so we went up to a meeting and we presented ourselves and, you know, talked about, you know, how we're qualified for the position and, you know, what we do in the community and what we want to see and what we would work on to improve our community.
And you were selected 3-1, correct?
Correct.
That's amazing. So, that's astounding. So Jewel and Brian, you both went through the election process. I'm wondering if you could talk to what that experience was like and perhaps if your experience was different given your age and being a person of color. Brian, let's start with you.
I'll address the age and person of color aspect. I would say it definitely affected me in terms of age, but did not affect me in terms of color. Delano is a predominantly Latina community, so that there was not much of an issue with that. But there was an issue with the age, given that I ran at 22. And the main question was, you know, there was two main questions. One is, why would you want to do this so young? And two, what experience do you bring as a 22-year-old? And those were sometimes questions meant to, like, invalidate my candidacy in the election. But it was also learning opportunities that I could provide them with.
And how did you address this question of experience?
Yeah, so in terms of experience, I would, one, make it about myself before making it about the council. I would say, you know, I've been doing this in student government for the past 2 years, and not only do I bring experience, but I bring ideas that would implement more
inclusive policies and more progressive policies, policies that will make people who aren't often heard, such as immigrants, LGBTQ, and senior residents, bringing them to the table, because oftentimes we do like this general approach to policymaking, and that's what's been neglecting certain parts of the community in Delano. But two, I would also mention, you know, most of your council never did politics before city council, and so I'm not any different from them. It just, I'm trying to get involved earlier.
Great. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking to three elected officials who's serving on city councils throughout the Valley, all of whom are in their 20s. Jewel, tell us about your experience in Kingsburg. I understand you ran against an incumbent candidate, correct?
I did, and against against a young man. So, who was not a person of color. So to address the question of my age and my color, it played a huge role, I think, in people deciding if they wanted to vote for me or not. I was constantly asked the question of, just like Brian, why would you want to do this? But at the time, I was 19. So I also walked up to their door with a baby on my hip or in the stroller or in a carrier. And I haven't finished college yet. I'm still in college. And so I think they were just kind of like, I think they thought it was a joke. I think they thought maybe I was just being funny or cute. But I was very serious. And I was constantly asked, why are you doing this? And probably not going to vote for you. Like, it's just probably not going to happen. And I would always say, and I talk about this all the time, but just give me 5 minutes and let me just share with you my vision. Because in Kingsburg, it's a small town. We're a Swedish village and we stick true to our values. And we're a very small community. And I think that when change comes, sometimes it can be scary for people. But just trying to make them understand that I'm just a neighbor and I just wanted to better our area, because we're in districts now. So it's focused on a particular part of town that I know very well because I grew up there. And so to also bring my baby into the picture and say, like, hey, this is my son. This is why I do what I do. Also, I think it brings maturity to the game, because a lot of residents could see, like, okay, yeah, she's 19. Yeah, she just got out of high school. Yeah, she's in community college. And her experience is maybe only serving on the commission. But she has that baby. And I think a lot of people know that you grow up really quick when you have a baby.
Absolutely.
So, and then the person of color aspect, I mean, it was just different for people to see.
So. Absolutely. Yeah. So, Esmeralda, shortly after being sworn in, you were right there on the council making decisions. Can you speak to what the last few months have been like on the council? How's it going?
So I remember that meeting very clearly. It was one of the most difficult council meetings I've ever had, just because it was very crowded. You know, there were a lot of concerned citizens. And I was really proud to be on that council sitting there, because luckily I had the experience, you know, with you know, knowing the Brown Act, I was familiar with that. So that also gave me a boost, and that made me more confident in, like, being able to participate in that meeting right away after my swearing in. So, yeah, there's been very difficult and challenging issues in our city coming up, from high density housing to other positive things like water infrastructure, you know, receiving money from the state, having new projects going on and moving forward rapidly in our city. You know, that's really nice to see, and having a council that's really moving things forward for our city.
Brian, I'm curious, from your perspective, what challenges have you encountered since taking office?
There's a huge intergenerational difference in terms of how we value certain votes and certain communities. I think so far, three of the biggest struggles I've had is bringing up police accountability, bringing up separation of church and state, and bringing up how we can do more as a local government to uplift and protect our undocumented community within the city limits. And so I mentioned those three because whenever you bring up police accountability, there's a defense mechanism that goes on within some individuals. I would say a majority of the people who are within council, but also who are considered community leaders. And so there's that roadblock for separation of church and state. There's a huge Christian presence. I say Christian presence because they're the ones who are the ones that get most upset when I say that we need a separation of church and state, rather than, you know, paving the way for more In God We Trust decals and just constructs within city limits.
Yeah, fascinating.
And three,
issues. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and three was, I tried to extend SB 54, the California Values Act, which declared California a sanctuary state, to Delano. It took a while, but it passed. But I had a lot of concerns about, we're just going to bring more crime to the city. Like, you don't know what you're getting yourself into. We're going to have to pay for this. And it's just misconceptions rooted in, some racism and also just exclusiveness. And it's interesting, given that more than a third of Delano's community is considered foreign-born, and that's not even considering an accurate estimate of undocumented people in Delano.
That's fascinating. And it really speaks to the seriousness of the issues that you were all encountering on a regular basis in terms of shaping the futures of your community. Jewel, as a younger person, a younger adult, what is the unique perspective you feel you bring to your position?
Yeah, you're right. A lot of the council members that are up there with me are, one of them was my principal in eighth grade. So to sit there with her and the other people on board, our mayor has very youthful energy. She's the reason I got started on a local level in the first place. And so the perspective, I guess, that I bring is just entirely different. I was telling my friend Alex in the car that sometimes they use just like older terms. It's not even like a big word. It's just older person's terms, I guess, is the right way to put it. And I'm like, what the heck are they talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. I know what issue we're talking about, but you're bringing like almost like an older person language in here. And I'm 20. So let me bring 20-year-old language in here. Like, it's super funny, like trying to find a balance. But we work really well together. And the perspective I guess I bring is just remembering the kids, remembering the young people, because I think a lot of times they're just focused on an adult crowd. And for me to say like, okay, well, what about this that the kids would really want, and things like that.
So. Absolutely. So we just have a minute before we wrap up. Esmeralda, what advice would you have for somebody who's in their 20s, maybe listening to this conversation and thinking, I would like to step up and serve?
I think the key is to not be afraid to take on a role in your community. Do not be afraid to get out of your shell. Volunteer, get out, do some community service, be involved. It all begins, in your school. Get involved with clubs. When you're in college, get involved with student government. If poli sci is your passion, just be involved. That would be the key to opening up a world that has a lot of great things and opportunities to offer. So I'd say don't be afraid, because you never know what opportunities will be out there for you.
Great. Well, thank you all for being with us today. We look forward to seeing what all of your futures hold.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. In the past, when government agencies and the media requested court records from the Kern County Superior Court, they could typically get them for free. Well, that changed last month, due in part to huge volumes of record requests. And it's part of a national trend. FM89 reporter Monica Velez joins me in the studio to talk about why this matters and whether tacking on court fees has the potential to violate constitutional rights. Hi, Monica.
Hey, Carrie.
So what exactly changed here, and when did that happen?
Yeah, so the changes started on September 1st, and the courthouse used to make it free for government agencies to get copies and certification fees for criminal records, but not anymore. Now they're going to have to pay 50 cents per page and a $25 fee per document they want certified. So this also applies to all media. Reporters used to get criminal and civil records free of charge in Kern County, but not anymore. And on top of that, media organizations will also be charged for offsite retrievals, and that's when someone has to get records that are stored outside of the courthouse, and that's going to cost $20 per file.
Okay, that's a big change. But why does this even matter? Why do journalists in particular need to access records, and could this become prohibitive for some journalists?
So court records can be very important for reporters depending on what you're covering. For example, I've covered stories about sexual abuse survivors who have sued priests and school officials. And in my experience, oftentimes for stories like these, school districts and dioceses won't outright tell you what happened or what the allegations are. But court records will. So for some stories, I wouldn't have been able to give people the full picture without these documents. And these are all of public interest, especially when sexual abuse accusations are against priests and teachers, who are people kids and adults naturally trust.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any idea of why the court actually made these changes?
So in a statement, officials at the court said it's because of the increased cost and labor that goes into record requests. These changes are pretty consistent with what other courts do. I talked to Timothy Draklis, who's a Fresno State professor in the Media Communications and Journalism Department. He says charging people for public records is a national trend because of the volume of requests courthouses get.
Okay, so far we've been kind of talking about this from the perspective of journalists, but we're not the only people making these requests, right?
Exactly, yeah. So while reporters do need access to court records to pursue some stories, Draklis says it's a misconception that reporters are the only ones making most of the requests.
The number of media outlets hasn't changed that much over time. While the media is certainly more aware of public records and their power in telling stories, and they certainly have made more than they used to, a lot of these requests are coming from other places. They're coming from private citizens. They're coming from campaigns. They're coming from interest groups. They're coming from concerned citizens who are worried about a specific issue.
So is this legal? Do courts still have full authority to do this?
Yeah, for sure. And it's courts all over the country who have started to tack on more fees. Draklis says some people request records just to request them, unlike media and government agencies who are doing it for a purpose. So adding on fees like this has become an effort to kind of discourage people from requesting thousands of records that are broad and not for a specific purpose. And sometimes it can take months or even years to, you know, gather and compile all of this information.
I'm very sympathetic to what the court officers in Kern County have to put up with and go through. And I'm not critical at all of what they're doing. It's a reality situation. But for the average person on the street who maybe wants to, they don't have very much money and they're, you know, a friend or a relative might be in jail and they want to look at the court file to see if that would be a problem. If you're a lawyer and you're not exactly making hundreds of thousands of dollars and you need to get documents so that you can appeal a case or look at a sentencing to see if there was any grounds for appeal, you need to pay for those documents.
This also brings up some larger questions about people's constitutional rights. Here's Glenn Smith, who's the litigation director for the First Amendment Coalition.
There is a constitutional right of access to court records. That's pretty clear. So the question becomes, at what point has it become so burdened by fees and delays that for all practical purposes, that constitutional right no longer exists?
He also says tacking on fees can violate people's rights when they are part of a case that's going through the judicial system.
Technically, now, if you're a party to litigation, you should be getting served with court records by the other side. But that's not always the case. That doesn't always happen. And you may need to take a look at the file to see what's happening to your case.
Okay, so we've mostly been talking about fees that have changed recently, but there are other fees that were pre-existing that are still in effect, right?
Yeah, so most courthouses charge a printer's fee. At the Kern Court, they charge 50 cents per page to print documents. You can also request records electronically, but there's a fee with that too. And if it takes longer than 10 minutes to search the records, they charge you $15. Other courthouses in the San Joaquin Valley do this too, like Tulare County Superior Court. Fresno, Merced, and Kings counties have documents you can download online. You still have to pay for those too. At the Madera County Courthouse, you have to call in to get information on court cases or go there in person. There's very minimal information online there.
So are all these fees considered high?
Glenn Smith says these are high, and they will likely just keep getting higher until someone challenges it. Although it will probably take a news organization or an organization like the First Amendment Coalition to challenge these fees, you know, because the average person doesn't have the capacity to challenge the system. And Smith added that he doesn't doubt courthouses are facing budget issues.
But I also think that providing public access to court records should be part of the DNA of the court system. And to start nickel and diming, or not even nickel and diming, to start $10, $25 here and there, you know, asking individuals to pay those fees to get access to the records at some point does become a violation of the constitutional access rights.
So is that why you were interested in looking into Kern County's fees?
Yes, it's in the public interest to know when there are changes or increases to any type of fees to access public information.
Very interesting. Monica Velez, thanks so much.
Thanks, Gary.
When we talk about climate change here in California, it's tough to ignore the dairy industry. State data show dairies contribute about 3% of the state's annual greenhouse gas emissions. That's already an improvement over the past, but a state law requires the industry to rein in its methane footprint even more in the next decade. Here to speak more about how this is happening is Michael Bocadoro of the coalition Dairy Cares.
Dairy Cares is a coalition that the dairy industry put together about 18 years ago to come together and work on sustainability issues. They're becoming very important, not just from a state policymaking basis in dealing with issues like climate change and water quality, but also from a consumer standpoint. Consumers want to know more about how their food's produced, and Cares was put in place by the California industry to help accomplish that.
And so are dairies sustainable in the long term?
They are. They're sustainable today here in California, and they're getting more sustainable. We're doing a great job. It's a great story that the California dairy industry can tell about its sustainability, its carbon footprint in particular, and how we're taking that even to the next level.
Right. And so today we're specifically talking about methane emissions from dairies. So methane, a potent greenhouse gas, it's produced in dairies in two main ways, by cow burps, but also by fermenting manure. And the manure emissions are now being kind of targeted by projects called digesters. 30 or so are now in operation in California. Dozens more are in development. They process manure in a way that captures a lot of that methane that would otherwise be released in the atmosphere. Can you explain a little bit more about how these digesters work?
Sure. It's a great story. So we're taking basically cow manure, and we're turning it now into electricity, renewable electricity, and what we call carbon negative transportation fuel. So it's a fairly simplistic process. The manure is put into a digester where the gas can then be captured. And so in a lot of dairies here in California, that's simply covering an existing manure lagoon where we store manure until we can utilize it as fertilizer for our growing operations. We are allowed to then capture the methane, and we can clean and condition that methane and actually turn it into low carbon or even zero carbon or negative carbon transportation fuel here in California. We're replacing diesel, and so we're not only getting greenhouse gas benefits, but we're getting air quality benefits by also reducing NOx.
And so when you look at the list of all the digesters either in operation or in production, I mean, almost every one of them is here in the San Joaquin Valley.
Almost all of them are here in the San Joaquin Valley. There are a couple up in the Sacramento Valley, and there are a couple up on the North Coast. But for the most part, yes, the overwhelming majority of our dairies are in the San Joaquin Valley. And so it's natural that the overwhelming majority of the digesters would be here as well.
And then there are a couple different models, right, where the digesters themselves go on individual dairies, but then you have some newer projects happening that are kind of big clusters of digesters?
Yeah, we have a number of clusters that are going in here in the San Joaquin Valley, and these are clusters of existing dairies. These aren't new dairies that are coming into production. These are existing dairies that are working together as a cluster to more efficiently and economically build these projects. And what they're, the basic model is what we call a hub and spoke. And so the hubs are each of the individual the spokes are each of the individual dairies, and the hub is the centralized cleaning and conditioning facility where we can then inject the gas into the pipeline.
And of course, not all perspectives on methane digesters are totally positive. There are a lot of environmental groups who have pushed back, arguing either that dairies are still unsustainable even with these reductions, or that dairy producers may now actually be incentivized to kind of grow their operations? I mean, what, you know, are these fair assessments?
Let's start with the latter one first, the growing, and that's really not happening here in California. We are actually seeing a reduction both in the number of dairies and in the number of cows that we have in operation here in California for the first time. So we reached a peak about 2012 or 2013. Mm-hmm. We're always going to see consolidation in the dairy industry. We've been seeing that for 75 years. We have fewer larger dairies every year here in California. It's a tough place to be in the dairy business, in part because of our environmental and labor and other laws that we don't see in other states. And so I'm not sure it's a fair assessment, certainly on that front. And I think from a sustainability standpoint, the dairy industry also is making tremendous strides. We've been reducing the carbon footprint of a glass of milk for over 50 years. And today we have far fewer cows than we had 50 years ago, both here in the United States and in other parts of the world, producing more milk. And on a national basis, we have about a third the cows that we had 50 years ago. We're producing 60% more milk. So what that means from a carbon footprint standpoint is that we've dramatically reduced by over 60% the carbon footprint of a glass of milk. And so you can feel really good about drinking milk today and should feel really good about drinking milk. And the beauty is we've got a great story to tell because we're making that better. Dairies are putting in solar projects on their dairies, renewable energy projects on a regular basis. We've got 70 in Tulare County alone and well over 100 here in the San Joaquin Valley. More and more dairies are putting in digesters. We're working across the board energy efficiency to produce more milk with fewer natural resources, fewer fossil fuels, less water, across the board sustainability improvements. So yeah, it can be frustrating when we continue to still get criticism, but California should certainly, and the dairy families here, certainly keep their heads high because they're doing far better than anywhere else in the world. It's a tremendous story and we're going to keep telling it.
And so do these energy projects, do they make dairies, individual dairies in the dairy industry, more economically viable?
It's still to be learned for sure, but the economics have to make sense for these projects. They're not inexpensive projects, and even though there is some grant funding available, that grant funding is being matched on a 2 or 3 to 1 basis by outside investment, either from the dairies or other investors. And so they absolutely have to make economic sense or they wouldn't be going in. And so everything we've structured here in California with reducing dairy methane is all through incentive programs designed to get those reductions and do it in such a way that we're not putting the dairies out of business. And if we did, all that would happen is those cows and that production would move elsewhere and we'd actually worsen the environmental issues because we'd be producing more methane. We're far more efficient here in California than we are in other countries and some other states. And so really important that we do it the way we're doing it. And the beauty is it's working. We're making great progress in terms of achieving what the state's asking us to achieve. And what the state's asking was fairly aggressive.
Right. And so by 2030, according to state law, dairies are required to cut methane emissions by 40%. Are we on track to do that?
We are. And CDFA just last week, the California Department of Food and Agriculture just last week announced that we're already more than 60% of the way to achieving that 40% reduction. We've got 25 of that 40% already with just the projects that have been funded to date. They're not all built yet, but as they come online, we're more than on our way, and we're just 3 years into the new requirements and the new goals that the state has set for the dairy industry. And we're working to even surpass those goals to the degree that we can.
Great. Well, Michael Bocadoro is Executive Director of Dairy Cares. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. You've likely seen the Green California sticker with the words, "My job depends on ag," on cars, trucks, and tractors around the valley. Behind that slogan is a Facebook community of farmers and ag enthusiasts. And now they have a TV show. It premiered this week on Valley PBS and is called American Grown, My Job Depends on Ag. Today, I'm speaking with Jeff Aiello, executive producer on the show, which started its season with the sticker. So, Jeff, for those listeners who don't know, how do you explain the My Job Depends on Ag movement?
I became aware of the movement when I did a film, a documentary for Valley PBS a couple of years ago called Tapped Out, which was a water documentary. I had always seen the little green sticker on people's car windows, the decals, like Green California and the white My Job Depends on Ag lettering on it. And I always thought that, first of all, I thought the logo was sort of like rough. Like I thought it's not well designed from a graphic standpoint. But then the more I looked at it, the more I liked it and I loved it. And then I started meeting the people that were flying it on their trucks when I started doing this film. And so when I did Tapped Out, we turned the camera off and these guys would say, "Man, do you know about all this other stuff that's going on that we're on, that agriculture is sort of under an attack in?" And I didn't know a lot of those stories. So that's sort of what the movement, to answer your question, how do you explain the movement? In episode 1, which premiered on Valley PBS this week, mm-hmm. it's really about a frustration. It was born from a frustration from agriculture that they were being painted in a bad light, to be, you know, blunt about it, by the hardcore environmental left. I believe there's environmentalists on both sides of the aisle. There's a lot of farmers that would tell you that they're probably the original environmentalists. There's a lot of hardcore extreme leftist environmentalists that would like roll their eyes at that want to see agriculture go away for, you know, globalization purposes. We'll just import our food from other countries without really understanding like what that means, what that exposes you to. And so that was really what the movement was born from, was that desire to have unification with all growers in the valley, and then to try to get the message out there that agriculture isn't a giant waster of water, doesn't pollute the environment, that they're actually just trying to grow our food source.
And I think you mentioned earlier sometimes the, you know, being unsure about where agriculture comes from, and environmentalists somehow end up on one side and farmers end up on the other side. I mean, but is this show interested in at all in parsing out those politics?
Oh, definitely. This is not going to be a fluff. You know, a fluffy, you know, rainbow and, you know,
not just
butterflies.
Beautiful farms.
No, I mean, so visually we try to celebrate the beauty of agriculture because it is, to me, it's a beautiful thing to look at. But when you speak about environmentalism specifically, because really when you get down to it, the big battle between, if you're going to say there's two sides to this debate, it's going to be between environmentalism and it's going to be between agriculture. And what's puzzled me through this process and puzzles some of the folks in agriculture is why that has to be that way. When you look statistically at California's water use, for instance, the environmental – I hate using the term environmental left. It's not a fair term to use, and it paints too many people that aren't – that happen to be left politically but do support ag. So my apologies to any of your listeners out there. That's not what I'm trying to say. But there is an extreme element to either side of the political aisle, right? And on the environmental side of that, you see the desire to want to globalize and import food from other countries as a rationale for eliminating agriculture here. And here's my biggest point on that that I try to make. And we're doing that in the show. We're going to dive into this on the show. If you really care deeply about the environment. My question is that just the environment where you live, or do you care about the environment globally? Because if you're going to push agriculture out of this valley, where it is the safest grown food, it's the most regulated grown food in the world, all you're doing is externalizing the need for that food to another part of the world where it will be grown far less carefully and will actually hurt the environment. And so I know that the agriculturalists that I speak with and work with here, and we're showing in the show, they are all about, come on to the farm. Let's get to the table and talk. Let's do this together. It's a little lopsided right now. And so that's one of my reasons that I'm passionate about this show, is not to counter what I call false information with other false information. It's just tell the truth and then let the people decide.
I want to ask, in the last minute we have, setting aside that you are a producer of a show about agriculture, but just maybe as a cinematographer, do you feel that your job depends on ag?
Here's the thing. That's kind of the secret sauce to this whole thing, right? Is all of our jobs, all of our lives sort of depend on ag in ways that we don't consider. You know, you're wearing a really cool sweater right now. Agriculture made that sweater come to life, right? We all eat. Mm-hmm. We all drink water. You live in a house that was probably made of lumber. You know, you have furnishings in your house that probably have cotton in them. So we forget that as a society. I mean, America is one of the richest societies on earth. We are a food rich country, even though we do have a problem with homelessness in places. It's another topic, right? But we are a food rich country. Human beings do this. We take for granted the things that we have a lot of. And we have a lot of money, a lot of wealth in this country, and we have a lot of food everywhere. And so it's easy to forget, as we get into these newer generations, that agriculture touches our lives in ways that a lot of people don't consider. And that's why this movement was started, and that's why we made this TV show.
American Grown, My Job Depends on Ag can be streamed online at valleypbs.org. You can hear an extended version of my interview with Jeff Aiello online at kvpr.org. And finally, The Weeknd. That
That's music by the Grammy Award-winning legendary Count Basie Orchestra, which formed nearly 85 years ago while celebrated jazz musician and composer Count Basie was still alive. Next Friday, they'll be performing at the Visalia Fox Theater, and FM89's David Ouse got a preview with conductor Scotty Barnhart.
In a world with lots of big bands, what makes the Basie Orchestra distinct?
The feel and the sound. Basie's music has always made people feel good. It's never been too overly cerebral, although there are many things in it that are, but it's always been a perfect balance of the cerebral and the just the feel-good simplicity of a good tune or a good melody. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And then when you add to the fact that he knew how to get the right personnel, and the key ingredient is the guitar. Had it not been for Freddie Green with the guitar, it could have been just like almost any other orchestra, but the guitar is our secret weapon. It helps the rhythm section to stay together. It provides a certain level of comfort for the soloists and stability for the soloists that you don't get in most other orchestras. And it's just a sound, man, and a feeling. Every time I put on a Basie record, no matter what the tune is, it makes me feel good, especially when I'm playing one or standing in front of the guys conducting one, you know, starting to tempo on one. It just makes you feel good, man. And Mr. Basie's personality is all in it. That was Mr. Basie's personality. He was a happy guy. Nobody ever had anything bad to say about him. You'll never find that. So I think that's really what the key has been. It's made you feel good. So people want to feel good. They don't want to feel like they always have to be on edge or think about what the musicians are doing. They just want to relax and enjoy the music.
To me, that's always the feeling of Basie. And you mentioned tempos. One of the things that's always struck me about Basie Orchestra, you guys swing at any tempo.
That's right.
And that's an amazing thing. It's not easy. It's not easy to do.
That's right, man. That's right.
The Basie Orchestra includes among its storied roster some of the great vocalists in jazz, and you have one of them living and singing with you right now. That's Carmen Bradford. Tell us a little about what Carmen adds to the mix. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's incredible, man. She understands everybody that came before, you know, that in the orchestra, but as well as the vocal tradition of Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Billie Holiday, and, you know, all these great musicians. She just knows how to deliver it. She knows how to bring it. She has the right amount of power to stand in front of an orchestra of 18 pieces and still not get overblown or, you know, drowned out. She knows how to pull us along with her. She's powerful. She's graceful. She's swinging. And you can't ask for anything else more than that. It's a joy to have her with us, you know.
For folks who attend or are thinking of attending the concert on the 11th in Visalia or the 12th in Bakersfield, what can they expect?
Well, they can expect to see and experience what swing really is, how 17 or 18 guys can play together so tightly, but at the same time so loosely that it makes you want to get up and dance. You'll be watching 84 years of one of the greatest orchestras in history still going, still playing, still at the top of its game, you know, still sounding great. And you can close your eyes when you walk in there, and in two or three beats, you'll know that's the Count Basie Orchestra, not any other orchestra. They'll be able to see why this orchestra is considered to be the swingingest orchestra in the history of jazz music.
Thanks so much, Scotty Barnhart.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
That was David Ouse with conductor Scotty Barnhart of the legendary Count Basie Orchestra performing at the Visalia Fox Theater next Friday. FM89 is a community sponsor of the event. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team, Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein,
Laura Satsui, and Monica Velez. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.